Welcome to Startupville, the show where we discuss what it's like to build a tech startup and a startup ecosystem in a small city. I'm Mike Wolsfeld, our host is Dan Gold, and joining him today is Jeff Wanzura.
I'm a pharmacist by trade, and the path I've taken is fairly unorthodox. I've been involved with a few different startups. A couple of these ventures have sputtered and failed, and two of these companies were lucky enough to grow and eventually exit. Through these ventures and through the startup ecosystem, we've taken part in two accelerators, one in Toronto and one in New York. So since then, I've been working in the specialty pharmacy and infusion clinic space, while also getting involved in the angel investor community and advising a number of early stage companies in Saskatoon and across Canada.
And Jamie Finney.
Co-founded an early stage venture capital fund called Cocopelli Capital. And so we invest in early stage companies primarily in the Rocky Mountain region. And then within the last year, I've also taken on the Western Slope Regional Director role for Startup Colorado, which is a nonprofit that's focused on building the startup communities of the entire state of Colorado and really supporting the community leaders and entrepreneurs, as well as advising the Greater Colorado Venture Fund, which is a venture capital fund specifically focused on startups in rural Colorado.
In this episode, we discuss the snowball effect that happens when smaller regions like Saskatchewan and Colorado start to grow their tech scene, and lessons learned in entrepreneurship. Welcome to Startupville. Startupville is brought to you by Innovation Place and Martin Charlton Communications.
I mean, you've got a number of things in common, not only probably an entrepreneurial spirit or a desire to make a difference, but you've both gone, is it fair to say full circle, that you've gone from just creating something for yourself to that next step of giving back, whether it's through, supporting other people through programming or then investing?
I actually have sort of found myself almost in that community role primarily. And so it started out with the internship program and working, helping start co-working spaces, things like that. And then as it's evolved, it's really been trying to hone in on what's the more effective way to do that. And that, as it turns out, continues to be somewhat in the nonprofit community building side, but also in the venture capital side. So those two, while on maybe totally different ends of the spectrum of capitalism, are very much in line with kind of supporting startups and communities, but actually haven't been the true operator myself.
And Jeff, what about your point of view as an investor going into that side of it?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair to say, is now that we've kind of seen where the landmines are through the few of the ventures that we've created, we have a few scars to show. And now we kind of see it as a way we can build the ecosystem in the prairies and in smaller centers and hopefully bring some of these lessons learned to the startups that we have the privilege of working with.
What do you see as the challenges when you want to go and invest in an organization and you see there's a great opportunity there? Do you sometimes have to step it back and start from a place of almost education? Maybe start with Jeff on that.
Yeah, so I think like the way our deal flow works is a lot of these, we really focus on the problem that we're solving for that end user. And when it comes to different verticals or different industries, as well, how can we solve that problem for the end customer? And each of these people are knowledge experts in their specific fields. So I don't think it's really our job to tell them how to solve that problem for the customer. We're looking at what that long tail effect is going to be over the course of their business venture and hopefully helping them bring the right people in if they are missing a skill set or they need some type of capital infusion or other types of things to help support them along the way.
Jamie, is that the similar model to you?
Yeah, I would say for us, I'll speak from the perspective of Cocopelli Capital, is really, as we're investing, we aren't a typical fund in that, you know, it was a few guys who had some big exits and then went on to start a fund. But really, it's myself and two other partners, and we're all relatively young, but able to be at the center of a very active ecosystem. And for us, it's kind of that same needs assessment. And then we're really trying to bring in a community similar to what Jeff's saying, where a lot of times it's looking for maybe where are those holes to plug and who are those right people, and really leveraging the expertise of, you know, really folks like Jeff that have, you know, an amazing experience in medical and that kind of thing.
One thing that intrigues me, I mean, it really intrigues me, a number of startups and organizations start with a really clear idea of this is what we want to achieve. I was looking at my notes for patient prep. That came around as a part of a hackathon. Was that how it worked?
Yeah. So actually one of the, our co-founders, Dr. Ryan Sander, had this problem throughout the course of his practice that he tried to solve using a very archaic or analog method using paper-based sheets. He said, you know, technology can help adapt and improve the workflow for me. So one thing I really saw benefit in is his expertise at the ground level and understanding that need, and also his network. And he's a bit of a technology savvy person as well. So using his expertise on the medical technology and then bringing in Dan Marino, who's also a tech savvy person, who's actually the brains behind the operation and the code base.
I'm curious, what was the context of that hackathon that kind of brought everyone together?
So it was dubbed as Hacking Health. And what they essentially want to do is create those collisions amongst multidisciplinary teams. So we had everyone from physicians to nurses to developers to business people. Then I squeezed in the door somehow. And we were able to combine. And it was really a problem statement that set off a lot of these projects in motion. And it was really good to see that throughout the course of that hackathon that a few of these ideas lived on and actually sustainable companies are built off of it. Because I think a lot of the times in these hackathons, it's everyone's rah, 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 and very energized for the very short sprint spurt. But how can we create, again, that type of mechanism to allow them to succeed over the long term? So one of the success stories, hopefully, from these.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And Jamie, with your organization, did you go through some form of incubation through a startup program, or was it straight off? You knew where you wanted to get.
I suppose it depends which organization, since I've got a few hats on right now. With Startup Colorado or Cocopelli Capital?
With the capital firm.
Yeah. We really kind of backed our way into starting a venture capital fund. It was three of us who have been working together, and originally we were actually all at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and one of the partners, my brother, Corey, he was starting his company right out of school. And then the other partner, Fletcher, he was in the middle of starting his company. And so, yet we're all students at CU, and we were looking at the state of the Boulder ecosystem. And it was kind of silly where we had Boulder, this mini explosion of startup activity happening. And then there's the Boulder Creek, which is not a very large creek. It's about 10 feet wide or 20 feet wide. And then you have the university, and like that creek was separating those communities entirely. And that just seemed absurd to us. So that was probably back in 2011. And we just from there said, you know, how can we address this? And the first thing we did was we started a speaking event, a TEDx event. And then from there, the snowball kind of started rolling, where my brother continued to grow his company and get more and more involved with the local community. And my partner Fletcher, he would go on to start a co-working space, which then I would help him with. And then he would work for a local venture capital fund. And I was running this internship program. So we kept kind of orbiting each other and either working directly with each other or alongside. And it was all centered around, you know, how do we build a stronger community and support our entrepreneurs? And then about 2 years ago, we got together and said, what is the opportunity here? Like, let's formalize working together for a very long time and supporting entrepreneurs. And perhaps there's some capitalistic opportunity there. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, it's a venture capital fund. It's the most uncreative business model ever. We could do that.
Here's a question to both of you. And I'll start with Jeff with this one. What is so bad about just getting a job and going to work for someone else? What is it within you? And this guy, I can see you both smiling, and it's not on the camera, but I can see you both smiling, because what is it like, go get a job, do a 9-to-5, get the paycheck, go home, 2.4 children, blah, blah, blah. Why entrepreneurism? Why build something yourself? Why deal with the pressure that comes with that?
So for me, I think it really comes back again to that problem statement. And when you're working with one of these large conglomerates, you have all the resources, but the ability to move and actually solve problems, you're a small piece of the puzzle. And if you see some other types of problems that you can solve, using your skill set, your expertise, or bringing other people on board, you can't really bring that passion and really drive that trajectory of how fast you can solve that problem or other problems that you can solve. So it's really double-edged sword, because sometimes I am remiss at the fact that we don't have a $100 million budget to help solve this problem, because there's a lot of problems you see throughout the course of vetting a few of these opportunities that we look at. But at the same time, when you're resourceful and you're strapped for funds, you have to become more and more creative in the way you're solving this problem. So I'd say it's the creativity and allowing you to really make a difference and not in the kind of buzzword term, making a difference, but more so, again, creating the companies that you're passionate about and spending your time and energy in ways that you can deploy that in different ways.
Yeah, I kind of want to just start with like a plus one for that. Really, the only thing I'd add is a little bit of kind of being the opportunity to kind of orient and kind of build the world you want to live in. And so for me, kind of supporting entrepreneurship and generally the path of entrepreneurship is very congruent with kind of providing opportunity wherever you are. And that gives you the freedom, kind of this amazing human freedom to be able to live with the people you want to live with and in the places you want to live with and build a community. And entrepreneurship is, I think, just the strongest lever that we have to be able to affect those outcomes, both for the communities we're building and for the actual companies we're building.
Something that intrigues me that I know an element of this market and how businesses, startups, and entrepreneurs have their ecosystem, and how the educational system has their ecosystem, and there's more collision now that we've got Colabs here, and Innovation Saskatchewan has been very active in bringing people together, and also other agencies, the commercialization side of university as well. To both of you, sometimes I've observed that there's maybe a divide between the education sector and the innovation that comes from there and private capital and private innovation. What would you say is a way to bring both of those areas together for the greater good and to, well, commercialize and bring jobs to an area? Maybe Jamie first.
Yeah. I think one thing that I was able to really learn in Boulder, that the fastest moving people at a university are students. And so it's really trying to provide students the tools and the resources to kind of just go do things. You don't have to know where it fits in a master plan for the university. You don't have to know how this lines up with, you know, a business school or a design school initiative. It's just sort of, if you want to see something, go try it and do it. And the outcome might be what you wanted, or it might be slightly different, but really orienting and like having that student momentum. Sometimes in large organizations, when things happen top down, especially, you know, publicly funded large organizations, it can be pretty slow to get the ball moving. And then once it does get rolling, it's definitely powerful. So you kind of need the students and the quickest ones to just start doing initiatives. And then that really, all of a sudden, universities and larger organizations happen to align themselves around that progress a lot quicker than maybe if it had started at the top.
Yeah, and from my angle, I think from a research standpoint, and we've had a little bit of exposure to this, but all the professors and the researchers that are spending 5-10 years on the development of these new technologies, the underlying foundational science, is, well, how can we empower them? Because I think the most beautiful thing that you could see is them utilizing or seeing people utilize their technology in the real world. So if they were to put all their time, energy, and passion into this project, how can we incentivize them to take it to the next level? And I think it's really that last mile that universities can really do a better job. And I'm thinking about the University of Waterloo, for example, where they incentivize their professors and their researchers to go down and actually see their product or their technology or their research make an impact in the community. And it's not just a fight for tenure, it's actually seeing this commercial and providing some type of incentive or motivation in place to recognize those efforts. So it's not just the base level science, but it's seeing these, again, enter the real world.
That's an amazing, I feel like, missing piece at so many universities. Like, we've absolutely seen companies where university research spawns off this amazing new tech company. And then you have the, I can actually think back to the company where it was a couple months kind of in limbo because the university was sort of haggling over the tech transfer agreement when really something like that, where if the people in charge just get to see like this technology that they've created, like there can't be anything more visceral and inspiring than that.
Do you think that sometimes bureaucracy is a challenge to progress?
Definitely. 110%. But it depends on the side of the coin you're on, because I think a lot of times when we're competing with the incumbents in an industry, it provides some opportunity for the young, nimble type players to enter the space. Where they're more lackadaisical, they have all the resources and they have all the customers. And we're starting to see opportunities and saying, where are they getting lazy and where are they not servicing that need well enough? So it's both a blessing and a curse on the bureaucracy side.
Yeah. I think from a community building side too, it's a challenge, but it's also this really, really strong tool when you need it. So in a sense, you kind of empower the grassroots entrepreneurs and community leaders to sort of do their thing. And then once you see something's working, that's that progress that you can kind of hand off to the bureaucracies that tend to also have really large budgets, and they can really pour a lot of gasoline on that fire to make a big impact once they get going.
One of the things that I'm interested in is intellectual property. Once you've come up with a thing and you then go, okay, the monetization for us is that side of it. Jeff, I'm looking at my notes. It just says New York selling Canadian rights. Tell me more about selling an IP, because a lot of the startups that we deal with see their project through and then sell the whole organization, or you know, they get out of it that way, but they don't necessarily sell the IP as a thing. Tell me how that worked for you.
Yeah, so the realization we came to is we put boots on the ground, we hit the pavement to go at clinic by clinic, physician by physician, to try and sell the software. And the one thing we started to learn really fast is the fact that we're competing with medical device and pharma companies who have budgets with two or three extra digits behind them. So when our lifetime value of a customer is a fraction of which, we said, well, who else in the ecosystem is having this touch point with the physicians and the clinics? And can we empower them to make a more compelling sales pitch? And how does this add additional value to their core offering? So in that sense, we saw a fairly good relationship evolve over time, where we danced before we really got in bed with these folks. And from there, they're taking the sales marketing risk, they have the network. And again, I think it's a win-win for both parties in that case. So we didn't want to, we had the ability to raise some money and really put some fuel on the fire. But if you look at the economics and in a very objective fashion, we'd rather work with people that can allow this technology to be deployed to more people faster.
And I'm interested in the lessons you've learned. I'm not going to go through all of them, because I'm sure there could be quite a few. But if you had, you know, and very often people don't talk about this, but the single hardest lesson you learned and what you did about it, that's the sort of thing that would be really interesting for the viewers and listeners. And Jamie, did you hit a brick wall at some point, or you faced a challenge, and how did you overcome it?
That was a heck of a question.
Thank you very much.
I think probably the best lesson, I don't think there is a necessarily point where we hit a wall, and this is maybe regarding Cocapelli Capital. It was with that fund, it's three of us, and none of us are paid full time to do that fund. And it's very much kind of the result of other work we're doing that we get this opportunity. And so as we were fundraising, there's no like wall hitting as much as the process of fundraising just sort of slowly pokes you and pokes you and pokes you until you kind of realize where it's leading you. And for us, a lot of that was around kind of just being extremely honest with ourselves about like, what are we providing and what are we good at? In a sense, that was the evolution of our pitch for fundraising. And it really helped us to be honest with ourselves about, you know, what are we offering here? What do we have kind of understanding and like being really transparent about our commitments and how we feel is fair compensation. So I think it wasn't really a wall as much as because we kind of had this fund that felt a little atypical to a typical venture capital story. It really forced us to be extremely intellectually honest, and I think also honest in like a compensation manner and a time manner, and like respecting the partners that we're with.
So is there an element of kind of the self-reflection, looking deeper within than you expected to before?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, since we closed on that, had like a first close with that fund, we've had all three of our partners have changed our actual jobs. And we knew that was going to happen over, you know, a 10-year fund that isn't your full-time job. There's no way all three of you just happen to have no life changes. It happened so quickly that I think that had a really, that was a forcing function for a lot of good conversations where it was, okay, here's what we promised, you know, investors, entrepreneurs that we're supporting. And how do we make sure that we're following through on those promises for this, you know, side job type thing? And so it really helped us kind of be really intentional and really honest with each other about like, what do you have to offer and how are we working together to be, you know, aligned, not just for us within a partnership aligned, but aligned for all the founders that are at the center of this, that it's most important for.
And Jeff, how do you reflect on the biggest lesson that you've learned?
And so I'd say the biggest lesson that we learned is how to ask the right questions and the power of no. So maybe it's a bit of a play on the Canadian versus American or New York mentality. But when we hit the sales or we hit the pavement and try and sell our product, we'd get a no and we'd kind of stop at that. We'd say that we tried Dr. Smith, Dr. whoever it may be. And when we started to go down to New York, they really press us and say, well, what's the reason behind the no? Unless you ask that second order question to really qualify why someone's saying no, you can't change your strategy and whether or not you're solving a true problem. So and I think once we were armed with that information, and I think it was a little bit of pushing and prodding us a little bit further and get out of our comfort zone. Once you hear that no, is it price? Because price you can change. Product is a little tougher to change, but it is adaptable, especially in a startup type setting. Or is it positioning? Is it trust? And once you understand that the underlying reason is to that no, then it can come back in 4 weeks' time and hopefully close that client later on.
I'd like to ask a question, and I'm going to ask this to both of you. It's a loaded question. I'm going to be absolutely honest with that one. And I don't know if Jackie's already queued you up for this, but I'm going to ask it. What's the importance of an address? What is the importance of having a big city address when you're trying to launch something, whether your email footer says New York on it or Saskatoon or a Colorado address? What difference does it truly make? And Jeff, that is very firmly to you first.
Yeah. So I actually shared this a few weeks ago at another session we did, but it was funny to realize that what we learned is the fact that we were selling to Saskatoon physicians, Saskatoon clinics with a Saskatoon address. And I think the small town belief is nothing good comes from your hometown. And we weren't vetted. We weren't qualified enough. But as soon as we went down to New York, we took part in the accelerator and we started to email Saskatoon physicians with that New York address. The tone slowly started to change. This is a big company from a big city selling to a small town. I feel fortunate that they'd give me a call. So we were able to see that in our sales cycle, the response rates, the open rates, et cetera, et cetera. So I say it's an unfortunate scenario because great quality products are coming from Boulder. They're coming from Saskatoon. It's just the fact that people need to start realizing this. And just because it has a New York address doesn't mean it's quality.
I'm curious, since then, is there anything that you can do almost in educating your own culture around, you know, hey, we have amazing products coming from your neighbor?
Yeah. And I think it's really a grassroots movement. Once people start to see a few of the exits, a few of the technology companies that are really starting to scale, they realize that quality products can come from here, but it's a virtuous cycle. It self-fulfills itself as soon as you have some success in the ventures that are located here or from Boulder, from other smaller centers. So it's not a little one-time fix. It's going to be a journey.
And that's fascinating because I can tell you what happens when I email people. If I email people locally, they go, blah, 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 yeah, whatever. If I phone them with this accent, it's amazing how meetings are secured significantly quicker. And it's the same product, it's the same service, it's the same people, but for some reason, a bit like a movie villain, if you've got an English accent, it means more.
Even after yesterday's loss?
Well, you know, and just to put this into perspective, we are one day past the World Cup exit, and you know, I think the England guys did pretty well. But I'm going to leave the sport there, because when I get on to North American sports, I'm completely lost. So I'm staying my safe zone and just saying I think they did well. culturally, being in a smaller sense, we've spoken about collaborations with people from different projects, or bringing people in and retaining them. Do you find, in line with other people in your organization, that there is this better retention rate with partners and employees or other stakeholders because you're in a smaller area, rather than being in a bigger center where people tend to, you know, want to fill out that resume with name a company at a far accelerated rate?
I think there absolutely is. There's, and it's actually kind of gone through an evolution where there was as the startup community in Colorado has evolved, it really early on, I think it was this fluke that you had storage tech and early companies that existed here. And then you had kind of that generation turnover of people who saw it's possible once, and now you have a new generation of founders that are starting companies. And then I think very early on, this like collaborative nature formed. And once that formed, I do think it really changed the narrative. And at that point, and that's really where I can say, like, as I was watching that, when I got involved in the Colorado startup community, that people were, I think, super proud of where they were. And you had Techstars that was started in Boulder. And, you know, for a while, Techstars would even say, you know, we're not anti-Silicon Valley, we're just pro everywhere else. And they were very strong advocates of this kind of give first community ethos. And because of that, I think you end up building a lot of just very informal loyalty to your fellow founders and service providers and community builders and that kind of thing. And since then, I think now you actually have this critical mass where you don't have nearly there. You know, there are still folks that go to the Bay Area for their startups, and there's always going to be some of that. But now you actually also have companies like Slack that are now putting headquarters in Colorado. And so it's almost like that collaborative nature is at the very beginning is what started the entire flywheel. Like, that was the seed to get planted.
Yep. And I'd say the other thing that I'm starting to see is more anecdotal than anything, but we're starting to see some folks that have had that big city experience be repatriated back to these smaller centers, where they view the quality of life, less traffic, and they can spend more quality time with their family. And when they are at work, they're more focused on that. There's less distractions to keep them at bay. So I'd say there's definitely benefit in the small town. And I guess a small town, I should say a small center. Like, Saskatchewan has 300,000 people, so it's not like it's a small, tiny town. But we are kind of, and I guess the other added benefit is the fact that if you are a good person in a small center, people know. And if you're a bad person, people know. In a large metropolis, it's easy to kind of hide behind the curtain. But in this scenario, if you do find someone good, they're likely to stay, especially if you treat them well.
I would actually kind of, as you mentioned that too, like a small center, I think it's even starting to expand down to the small town level. That's definitely a big bet that we as Startup Colorado are trying to make, but we're seeing it happen where in Telluride, there's a founder who grew up in Telluride, has this rapidly expanding tech company, and he wants to get his headquarters based in Telluride, Colorado. He personally wants to have more people employed by his company than the ski area. And you have stories like that are happening over and over, or even Mercury Payment Systems in Durango. That's 16,000 people, and they moved to Durango. And, you know, the founder of that company said, you know, I want to live in Durango. And with his brother was his partner, and they said, you know, this is an amazing idea. This is how we're going to do it. And that was a great success. So I think even on the small town level, it's starting to happen. And I think it's we're trying to shift it from maybe anecdotally or this kind of interesting, fun story to, you know, how did that happen and how do we continue to get that happen? And you're seeing more and more people that are really wanting to move back home, but still take their careers and their aspirations back home.
I suppose that comes to the benefit of the evolving digital economy, where we really can be anywhere and do the work locally and still connect with the world. We haven't gone to a paperless society. We haven't got paper-free offices. I have got so much paper here. It's ridiculous. And look, my notes, they're on paper because it's just the way it is. Guys, I want to say a very big thank you for joining us on Startupville. As ever, I think it's really important that our listeners and viewers get the opportunity to be able to connect with you and your organization. So, Jeff, if we could start with you, how could people get in touch?
I guess, first of all, on Twitter, it's jwanzy, I'll spell it out for you, at jwandzy, or at jeff.wanzera@gmail.com.
And Jamie?
Yeah, you can reach Startup Colorado on Twitter, just at Startup Colorado, all one word. And then I'm easy to find, just Jamie at cocopelli.vc, K-O-K-O-P-E-L-L-I.vc.
Startupville is brought to you by Innovation Place, growing the tech sector in Saskatchewan, Canada, and produced in partnership with Martin Charlton Communications at WeTellYourStories.ca. The show is produced by me, Mike Wolsfeld, and our host, Dan Gold. Our theme music is from GG Riggs and Reactor Productions. Learn more about us and our guests at innovationplace.com/startupville, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at StartupvillePod. See you next time on Startupville.